these rules are great, and the things we take, and the jobs we hold, and the land is stolen, and the too, and the love for you.
From the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism in Times Square, this is Audiophiles. I'm your host, Franz Koster. Thanks for joining us. Are you upset at the state of education in the country? Maybe you want to publish your music but don't have a record label. Or maybe you want a gourmet meal without the gourmet price tag. Today on Audiophiles, we explore do-it-yourself culture in our city. Who practices it, why, and what happens when it goes wrong? We'll hear about the improvised sleeping arrangements at Occupy Wall Street and learn how DIY canning can lead to explosions.
That was it. You know, they were dodging exploding jars of tomato sauce and they had no tomato sauce for an entire year.
We'll also talk to an expert on a surprising trend in education, unschooling. But first, we take you to a fair, Maker Faire. There's no shortage of do-it-yourself workspaces in New York. At NYC Resistor in Crown Heights, tinkers break open and modify gadgets. Amateur biologists isolate and analyze DNA on homemade sequencers at Genspace in Flatbush. And aspiring pilots can build their own radio-controlled planes at the Brooklyn Aerodrome in Williamsburg. But when it's time for a labor of love to see the light of day, Maker Faire has been the place to share work with like-minded artisans. While the DIY movement is the heart of this event, household names like GE and Microsoft are finding that this gathering of bootstrap techies is a date they can't afford to miss. Ian Chant attended the gathering of inventors at Flushing Meadows Park in Queens last month. He has this report.
That's the sound of a robot, just strolling around like it owns the place. It's a noise you get used to surprisingly quickly at Maker Faire. The event started in 2005 in San Francisco, and this year we'll see three separate events, one back in the Bay Area, as well as shows in Detroit and here in New York, where makers bring their drum-playing robots, their fire-breathing dragons, and their meat jacuzzis. Yeah, they're meat jacuzzis.
A meat jacuzzi is a water oven. And it's a precise cooking mechanism. It never goes above 100 degrees Celsius. It never boils. And let's say you have a steak at 57 degrees Celsius. That melts the fat and also the collagen into the meat already.
According to inventors Lisa Chi and Abraham Fetterman, it makes even cheap steak taste like prime cut. They didn't come up with the idea of cooking meat in cool water. That technique, known as sous vide, has been around for hundreds of years. But they did design a kit that will let you build your own water oven at home. And all you need is $100 worth of electronics and a little bit of elbow grease. The variety of projects on display, from robots to homemade stuffed animals, means that the fair is a great place to meet people working on almost anything. Graham Brademeyer runs Pipeline.com, an online collaboration space for do-it-yourself artisans and engineers.
It's probably the best way I've seen in the real physical world to bring everybody together. You just feel the energy here, so that's what it's all about.
People's pet projects are the centerpiece of the fair, but they're far from the only things on display. As the show grows in size and esteem, major players in the tech world are becoming more visible. Students from universities like MIT are out in full force. Six-legged chairs carry some around Corona Park in Queens. Others, like Emily Krebschek, show off devices that can diagnose disease using simple chemicals and Lego blocks.
We design relatively low-tech devices that can be used in developing countries to solve health problems that they have. I really like the way that this actually directly applies to people's lives. Like, tools that we make here have already been deployed in places like Nicaragua and are already helping people.
General Electric, Hewlett-Packard, and Microsoft are all at this year's Maker Faire, too. But they're not represented by PR flacks. When companies come here, they send their nerds. Like GE's Megan Rothney. She's using x-rays to measure visceral fat, the deep down fat that doctors think is really bad for you. She feels right at home at Maker Faire, and explains that most of today's household names in tech started out as an idea in someone's basement.
You know, I think the legacy of GE is Edison in his barn in Schenectady, you know, starting to come up with new ideas that everyone thought was wacky and crazy. And obviously GE has changed a lot since then, but I think at the very heart, we're still people who love invention. And I think we all think of ourselves as makers, even though it's what we do as our day job.
But for garage-based inventors, Maker Faire is not about new gadgets from Fortune 500 companies. Randy Serafan is technology manager at Instructables, a website that helps people share plans for do-it-yourself projects. He's surprised by the growing interest big tech companies are taking in events like Maker Faire.
There's always that sentiment that it's kind of an invasion, and I know because everyone's really self-reliant and really pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps, but I mean, it could mean good things because that means there's more money, and I know that's always a problem for people in DIY. And, I mean, anyone who tells you otherwise is lying.
While many makers are just weekend hobbyists, others are looking to bring their labors of love to market. It's business that brings Dr. Adventure, the founder of the New Flesh Workshop, to the fair. He's looking for customers as much as collaborators. His product? Superhero armor. Accessories crafted from high-impact plastic and woven carbon fiber that look stylish and can absorb a hammer blow. He welcomes the big companies.
I like that there's guys selling $100,000 laser cutters and a guy who built one for $50. Because then you can be like, hey, GE, check out what I made in my garage that's better than what you made.
For these tech giants, there may be more to Maker Faire than a chance to show off new toys. They could also be keeping an eye on future competition. From Flushing Meadows, Queens, I'm Ian Chant.
Maker Faire is spreading beyond bigger cities like San Francisco and New York. This month, residents of Fort Wayne and Pittsburgh can also check out local inventors and their creations. Samuel Clemens was a big believer in DIY. He even gave himself a new name, Mark Twain. The iconic American author once said he never let his schooling interfere with his education. A growing number of Americans have taken Twain's words to heart. Homeschooling is on the rise, an almost 40% increase since the 1990s, according to the U.S. Department of Education. Parents who teach their kids this way believe children learn better in the living room than in the classroom. They teach math and science and other courses themselves, often with help from educational websites and extracurricular activities. But some people don't think homeschooling gives kids enough freedom. Reporter Rebecca Lee Douglas brings us a story about unschooling, where parents don't give lessons and the children teach themselves.
Remember this? Of course you do. It's school. The place where every day, from ages 5 to 18, most of us spent about 7 hours of our lives. Remember waking up early, rushing around, trying to make sure that you look cool and that you're there on time? Well, 11-year-old Maya doesn't worry about things like that.
I usually wake up around like 9:30 and have breakfast. It depends on what we're doing because sometimes we have to leave earlier for stuff and then we just get ready and brush our teeth and stuff and go. And sometimes we just hang out here.
It's 10:30 on a Tuesday morning. Most New York City kids are in school, but Maya's here at her home in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Her 7-year-old brother, Ben, is quietly reading on the couch. He'll occasionally chime in, but he's insisted that he doesn't want to be recorded. He's pretty excited, though. He has a fun day planned.
He's going to a class called Wayfinders, which is in Central Park.
That's Ben and Maya's mother, Amy Milstein.
And it's basically a massive group of kids of all ages. But one of the main things they do is play Capture the Flag. And he hasn't done it yet. We're going to try it, see if he likes it.
For Ben and Maya, that's the way it works. They get to do what they like to do. They spend their days playing and hanging out and learning about what they're interested in. They're not homeschooled, they're unschooled, which means no school, no designated assignments, no thought-out curriculum. Kids learn what they want to learn when they want to learn it.
We're still sort of, even in the homeschooling community, sometimes, you know, the lunatic fringe.
Okay, troops, time for school!
A lot of parents would argue that kids need structure. Dr. Phil even has a chapter in his parenting book called Need for Structure. But Milstein thinks that it's silly that for the first 18 or 22 years of your life, education is spent in a classroom.
Kids who are able to reach out and pursue what interests them and use that as their learning experiences just get much, much further to knowing who they are and what they might like to do in life.
This is Lori Block-Spiegel. She unschooled her two sons, although she prefers the term child-led learning.
And by the time they got to college, they had the mindset, I think, of students approaching graduate school.
Spiegel and her husband sell Native American jewelry. When their kids were still in public school, they wanted to take them on buying trips to reservations.
We used to go to the schools and say, look, we'd like to take our kids with us on a buying trip. We'll be gone for 2 weeks. And they'd say, you can't do that. You're at your limit of absences after a two-week period, we'd have to fail your child for the year. And my husband would say, you mean that I have to sacrifice a great educational experience so that they won't be expelled from school? And they said, well, off the record, yes.
Her younger son, Solomon, showed an early interest in whales and marine life. Now he's on a scholarship to the College of the Atlantic, where he spends much of his time on a boat, in the ocean, studying whales. And Lori's older son, Colman, fell in love with costume design, script writing, and set building. He's now on a scholarship to NYU Film School. Spiegel also runs the website homeschoolnyc.org, which pools information for homeschooling and unschooling parents. She says that the question people ask her the most has to do with socialization.
You know, it's the question that's asked so often. We call it the S word. That's how bad it is. You can't go anywhere without people saying, but what do you do for socialization? The thought that this happens in a closet, that the child never leaves the house, that it's just the parent and the child, is actually couldn't be further from the truth.
Her kids were involved in unschooling groups. They did activities, they had internships, they joined clubs, but the whole thing was a lot of work for Spiegel.
In the homeschooling community, you typically have parents who have chosen to sacrifice at least one income in order to homeschool their kids.
A lot of families don't have the resources to afford this type of education. Just think, if both parents have to work, there isn't enough time in the day. So you don't usually see unschooled or homeschooled children from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. Clark Aldrich has devoted his life to educational research.
It's hard to generalize, but you know, there does have to be a parent around.
He knows that a lot of parents are scared of unschooling. They're afraid their child won't learn everything they need to. Maya hasn't done any formal math or science in over a year. But Aldrich says that unschooling parents see these same scary educational gaps with schooled children.
Why are they teaching what they're teaching? You know, why are they teaching, you know, calculus, for example, as opposed to combinatorics or discrete math? Why are they teaching biology as opposed to, you know, health or nutrition or something? You know, I think it's one of those things where the further back you pull from schools, the more you realize how tall the stack of assumptions are that we've all made collectively for, you know, for good reasons and bad, sort of have schools the way they are.
There are about 2 million homeschoolers in the country, and a fraction of those are unschoolers. It's not clear how many are unschooled. Parents just can't seem to agree on the labels. But despite their small size, Aldrich thinks that they may potentially make a big impact.
Right now, it is the homeschoolers and the unschoolers who are reinventing education in a very significant way. What schools should be doing over time is taking the best ideas that are developed in these homeschooling and unschooling communities and work them back into schools.
Some schools have made the kind of changes Aldrich predicts. Gaithersburg Elementary in Montgomery County, Maryland, recently gave up homework in favor of free reading. They wanted to, quote, get away from the worksheets and allow the students to read things they're really excited about. In New York City, I'm Rebecca Lee Douglas.
Hey, teacher, leave the kids alone.
We're now joined by Clark Aldrich here in the studio via phone. And if you have any questions for Mr. Aldrich, please call our studio. The number is 646-758-7870. Mr. Aldrich, thanks for being here, and how are you today?
Oh, very well, thank you.
So you've said in your book and in numerous articles, I remember a Washington Post article in particular, that we make a lot of assumptions about what's essential to an education. But there was a small study in Canada that looked at homeschooled, unschooled, and public school educated kids recently. It found, and I'm quoting, that children in the unstructured homeschooling group performed the worst across all academic measures. To what extent can we throw out the playbook? How do you react to a study like that if you are in favor of unschooling?
Well, again, studies are always odd, and I think studies are often made to reinforce certain images. So I think anyone who studies a lot realizes that their, you know, methodologies are there. I think we should be studying these things a lot, and we should be encouraging a lot more models than we currently have. I would say that it does make sense that someone who's not used to taking standardized tests would not necessarily do better in a standardized test than someone who is used to doing a standardized test. So I think it's very safe to say that schools are very good at teaching how to be a student in a very literal sense of the word, how to be a student in a classroom. So I think, again, if we have a very academic style examination, then sure, absolutely, that would be a very predictable outcome.
Right. So you're saying that the problem is more with the testing than with the actual material then?
I think the problem is always with the testing. I think that, you know, if you think about skills that we actually value in the workplace and we value in our economy, like leadership and innovation and relationship management and stewardship and whatever, boy, I haven't seen a good test to measure those things yet. So, you know, what we do in tests is we test little things that we can measure but aren't necessarily valuable.
But isn't our society structured in a way where you need to know some math, some science, and some things that average kids might not be interested in? And how do you gauge that if not by testing?
Well, there's two points. How do you learn it and how do you gauge it? I think how do you learn it, I think most interesting activities, I mean, if you have a farm stand, if you go and you know, take recycling to the dump and recycle it, or you know, raise animals, whatever, all those things require science, require math, require English. Most activities suck the important skills very quickly. Now, you mentioned science. Science is not... most things that are taught in science are not overly relevant, and that's why they're not overly remembered. Most kids don't remember what they learned in biology other than a couple of things like cells. Most people don't learn what they learned, don't remember what they learned in geometry, because these kinds of activities are not reinforced by the real world. So I'd like to measure sort of real skills much more than these sort of bubble academic skills.
What kinds of families are attracted to unschooling, and for what families is unschooling feasible?
I think those who are attracted to it just look at the school system and just say, this is just not a very good system. I think a lot of people, as they consider it, most people don't think about school. Say, of course, we're going to send our kids to schools. The question is, which one? Do we send them to private? If we can afford that, do we send them to public? Do we send them to parochial? That's sort of the primary question. But in all cases, there's oftentimes a reluctance of saying, I'm not sure what's going on here makes a lot of sense. I don't really like the program. I don't like what's being taught, but it's sort of what we do and or it's what I did. I think a lot of parents who are becoming more moving away from this very sort of set, finite, lockstep philosophy are saying, what else can we do here? How can we actually have much more authentic educations? One example that I use, or one analogy that I use in my book Unschooling Rules, is that of the frozen food section of the supermarket. A lot of, you know, imagine if we could only eat from that one part of the supermarket, how sick we'd all get. To a lot of people, schools increasingly look like this one-size-fits-all, mass-produced content machine that is not necessarily aligned with their own values and aligned with their own perception of how the world's actually evolving.
All right. What about building character? You mentioned in your answer to the question before last that biology and chemistry and some of the science taught in public schools is not really relevant to most people's regular lives. But sometimes you just have to learn something you don't want to learn or do something you don't want to do. A lot of people would say that's life. What's an unschooling reaction to that from that perspective?
Well, hard is good. You don't want to play tennis without a net. I think the challenge of real activities are critical. So, for example, let's just use an example from one homeschooler, raised chickens and sold the eggs by the road in a stand where people went by and bought them and put the money in the jar. That activity was a very real activity. It was very connected to the real world. It was involving animals and other sort of natural systems. And if the person did not put the hens away at night, a predator would come and kill them all. If it did not bring the eggs up, or in some cases there's vandalism or something and the eggs got smashed. I mean, the real world has plenty of activities. Another, children were helping out neighbors who became disabled setting up actually their web page so they can contact their families. These are all real activities that involve stress, that have real challenges to them. So the notion of, you know, most people by themselves, when they're doing worthwhile activities, have significant challenges for themselves. So I think overcoming challenges is a very critical part. I would probably argue that most school curriculum have sliced and diced the challenges into such small little tidbits that they're not. Most students are not really learning as much as following and applying little microprocesses that are done sequentially. And so I would say there's a lot more learning and a lot more tension going on, a lot more resolution of frustration, which I think is the critical part of learning happening in the unschooling environment.
Right. We have a question from a listener who... he wanted to know what, in your opinion, what science should be taught, what science is relevant in both a public school and an unschooled environment.
I think those around nutrition are probably paramount right now. Those around, there's a connection there between science and math where you have to understand how to make scientific decisions, for example, of, you know, arsenic parts per million. I think it was a debate a couple of years ago, and sort of understanding what the implications there are. So I think understanding increasingly combinatorics, permutations, probabilities, and learning how to apply those to the natural world and to yourselves. With, again, getting back to the nutrition side of it, truly understanding where our food comes from, how that food chain works, what's the impact of food on our own body, how do we maximize that part of it, and using ourselves to some degree as a small lab for saying what happens when I eat well versus what happens when I don't. I think that's a starting point for everything. Then you can extend out into, again, the natural world, whether it's taking walks out in trees and starting to look them up and understanding what they are, looking at, again, farm animals and farmlands and sort of what's happening with those, too. So I think the more you get into it, the more it broadens out into, again, both math and also science and economics.
But I'm glad that you mentioned nutrition. For one thing, it's important, and for another thing, it's a great segue to my next question,
yeah.
Which is when it comes to more advanced and complicated studies, what's the unschooling approach to that? In nutrition, there's all sorts of biology and medicine involved. For me, personally, I remember I was trying to learn the subjunctive in French and getting nowhere, although I eventually got it, and I still can't tell you the first thing about physics, so... At some point, isn't there a need for some standards, for some out-of-the-home instruction?
I think first of all, there's a thing called the Internet. You may have heard of it. And it has, gobs and gobs and gobs of information. Secondly, I think there are increasingly programs out there that are structured, that have a curriculum, not just loose content, that's being applied out there. I'd like to take your question one step further, if I may, which is, right now, we have a crisis in this country around what's called STEM areas, science, technology, engineering, and math. For me, when I see organizations like the Gates Foundation or the National Science Foundation trying to plug those holes, trying to increase the STEM capacity of our nation, what they're tending to do is create programs that they're then pushing out typically to public schools, and most of those programs die on the vine. Most of the public schools have been really, really bad at adopting new STEM-based programs, even when there's grant money associated with it. So for me, my thinking is, how do we get these same foundations to be focusing on homeschoolers and even unschoolers? How do you create content that people want to take, not have to take? And that's very possible. There's a lot of people who are very, very curious about chemistry, about engineering, about math.
Right.
And increasingly, so if you can create programs that these people, these homeschoolers and unschoolers, want to take and do take and will get graded and everything, because, a lot of kids do like that, especially in areas where they're interested in, then we as a nation take those programs and roll them out into public schools and private schools. So for me, again, looking at these homeschoolers and unschoolers is a terrific opportunity for increasingly rigorous content that's not accessed ad hoc, as it sometimes is on the Internet, but much more structured that kids will want to take.
Right. Now, I have another question from a caller.
Yeah.
But first, I'd just like to clarify a little bit about the Internet. I mean, I'm assuming that you don't mean websites like Wikipedia and such, right?
For some content, Wikipedia is fabulous. For other content, increasingly there's lectures online. Increasingly there's worksheets online. Increasingly there's communities online, which involve different real practitioners as well as students to discuss these things.
We have a question from a caller. He wants to know, or she wants to know, I don't know. Do unschooled kids suffer without the structure schools provide, socially, academically, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to categorize anything. I mean, to say, okay, here are the unschoolers over here and these school kids over here, and the school kids are all happy or they're all unhappy or the unschoolers. I think we just collectively have to get to a point where we have a much greater diversity of approaches. And, I'm hoping that 10 years from now we have kids who are half unschooled and half traditionally schooled.
Right.
So I think creating broad swaths of categories, the experiences are different. There are great things about traditional schools and horrible things about traditional schools, and some kids will thrive in that environment and some kids won't. One problem to some degree is most traditional schools are set up as an IQ test where basically they say, the top 20% are going to excel and the other 80% are not. And increasingly, the motivation for a lot of public school systems are, boy, if you don't do well, you're going to be over there with those losers.
Okay.
And that's a motivation of a traditional school system, which you can either argue is very effective and realistic or highly immoral and problematic. So, there are different environments. One of the problems of school, though, is that it does have a zero-sum component of winners and losers. And so,
right.
A lot of parents are concerned with that as a moral philosophy as well as a practical philosophy.
Okay. Mr. Aldrich, if I could get just like literally three words from you. Obviously, public funds go to public schools. Do you think that there should be such a thing as a subsidy for unschooling?
If there was, it should not be controlled by the Department of Education or traditional school structure.
All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Aldrich, for joining us today. I appreciate it. I really do. That was Clark Aldrich, an education expert and author of the book Unschooling Rules. Culinary tastes in our city are changing. The DIY food culture is changing with them. Your grandmother may have been canning tomatoes for years, baking homemade bread, and making jam. Today, the do-it-yourself movement provides a wider menu of choices as more people are making food they might order at a restaurant or buy in a store, such as gelato or artisanal cheeses. And some amateur beer brewers, butchers, and sauciers are looking to make a career out of their hobby. But as Michelle Bangert reports, turning passion into profit is not as easy as pie.
More than 2,000 people are gathered at the Brooklyn Local Festival. Some are sampling slabs of salted caramel apple pie, artisanal ice cream, and local beer. Rachel Wharton is an editor at Edible Brooklyn magazine. She says creative foodies are getting a new outlet for their interests.
People wanted, maybe used to want to be artists or rock stars, and now they want to be cooks or picklers or pasta makers or, you know, make ricotta and sell it from a street cart. I think there's also a lower barrier to entry for food making jobs. It's really hard to become a successful artist or rock star. It's hard to make good ricotta, but I think it's a little easier to at least try it out for a year or two.
And besides the element of fun, there's the potential to make money. Naomi Gagas-Downey of the nonprofit City Harvest started this event. She explains part of the appeal for home cooks and canners is the possibility of making a living at it.
I dream of being one of these vendors one day.
Bartering is another way to share your homemade products. Food swaps have sprouted up all over the country, from San Diego and Minneapolis to New York and London. One Brooklyn group called the BK Swappers started a year and a half ago and now has a waiting list.
And then further down, I'll show you
Meg
some more.
Meg Kottner started a queen swap group in March. Since then, she swapped maple vinegar and a homegrown butternut squash for a spicy pepper spread and marmalade. Kottner grew up in California and now gardens in her Astoria backyard.
Three plum trees.
She makes jams such as plum vanilla, fig walnut, tomato, and apricot. She does it for several reasons: the taste, the cost, and nostalgia.
It does harken back to another time, because it's very easy to buy everything processed. But not all of us want to buy food that's been processed by a large corporation.
But for some, cooking is the reward. That was true for Anne Noyes Saini. When Noyes Saini got married, she received an Indian mother-in-law and a recipe for her beloved spicy pickles. She still wanted to learn more about other cuisines and make her own kimchi and dumplings. But it was a special tomato sauce recipe that lured her from her home in Astoria to the Bronx. There, she studied with a Sicilian grandmother to learn how to can tomatoes. The process went smoothly, but she also learned about the dangers of DIY.
So I had no idea how perilous canning could be. I thought you just, like, dump it in and seal it up and put it away. And she was telling me how as a kid in Sicily, like, their whole stock of, like, a year's supply of tomato sauce that had been put up started exploding one night, and that was it. You know, they were dodging exploding jars of tomato sauce, and they had no tomato sauce for an entire year.
Canning requires careful sterilization. The cans crack or explode if water or other foreign materials get inside. This year, Noyes Saini started a food website called City Spoonful that explains how to can, preserve, and pickle, hopefully without any explosions. I'm Michelle Bangert.
We've heard what DIY looks and tastes like, but how does it sound?
Push it to the top. Push it to the top. You know you've got to push it to the top.
Well, it sounds something like this. You're listening to Human Superglue by the band Like I Was the Fire. When we come back, they play a live acoustic set, and we talk about DIY record production. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Randy Jackson.
When I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, I also learned about its serious connection with cardiovascular disease. I knew I needed to make some major lifestyle changes that would help me manage my type 2 diabetes. I am working with the American Heart Association to lead an educational campaign called The Heart of Diabetes and share tips that have helped me stay in the know and guide me toward a healthier way of living. Keep active, normalize critical health numbers, opt for a healthy lifestyle, and work with a healthcare provider.
I test my blood sugar every day, and I plan my meals and activities accordingly.
I visit my healthcare provider. He helps me stay motivated.
I take a brisk walk every morning and make healthy food choices.
I'm Dr. Dan Jones. These people are living proof that type 2 diabetes can be successfully managed. Please visit your own healthcare provider, and for more information, visit iknowdiabetes.org.
You're listening to The Audio Files. I'm your host, Franz Koster. Welcome back. And if you're just tuning in, we're exploring DIY culture in New York City. Like I Was the Fire is a band from Brooklyn, and their solution to the recording industry's dirge of fiscal doom is simple. Do everything yourself. They're here with us now in the studio to answer a few questions and play some songs off their upcoming EP, The Narrow Escapes. It's due out on Halloween. Whenever you're ready, guys.
This time that you would just stay a while for me, stay longer, a bit longer. I never thought that you'd mean this much to me, but I need you now. I don't know where you've gone, but now you're all I want again. Started at 3x5, my dear summer doesn't quite express what I need to say out loud. There's so much more that I just don't know how, but I need you now. Before the days grow cold and we grow old, summer come back. I remember those warm summer days, and now it's all so far away. Can't believe you leave me here so fast, with so much as a goodbye. Summer's gone again.
Summer's gone again.
Summer's gone again, with so much as a goodbye.
As a goodbye,
summer's gone again.
Summer's gone again.
Summer's gone again. With us so much as a goodbye.
Cool. That song was called Dear Summer. Next one's called Bounded in a Nutshell.
Don't call me sweetheart. You were a diamond in the quarry, the shining bright, a white light against the rock. You were a diamond in the quarry, smashed by sea or rust into a piece of coal. Oh, oh, oh. Call me crazy, just don't call me sweetheart. A burning moon is setting in your lungs.
diamond in the quarry. Those days are gone, you left them out in the cold. You were a diamond in the quarry, slipping down the slope that leads back to living alone. Call me crazy, just don't call me sweetheart. A burning moon is setting in your lungs. The fire's burning through you, your eyes. Call me crazy. Call me crazy. Call me crazy. Just don't call me sweetheart. Call me crazy. Call me crazy. Just don't call me sweetheart.
I try to lose myself, crawling my way to kicking and screaming to get your attention. I try to lose myself, crawling back up from pulling my feet, but
just don't call me sweetheart.
I try to lose myself, crawling my way to hell, kicking and screaming to get your attention. I try to lose myself, crawling back up from hell, pulling my feet, but they're anchored into the ground. Call me crazy. You're calling me.
Call me crazy.
You're calling me blind.
Call me crazy. Just don't call me sweetheart. Call me crazy.
You're calling me.
Call me crazy.
You're calling me crazy.
Call me crazy. Just don't call me sweetheart. Call me crazy.
You're calling me.
I tried to lose myself, clawing my way to hell, kicking and screaming to get your attention. I tried to lose myself, crawling back up from hell, pulling my feet, but they're anchored into the ground.
All right, we have time for one more, but real quick, do you want to introduce yourselves?
Yeah, my name's Jaime.
My name's Aremo.
All right, take it away.
All right, thank you.
What are we doing? Sorry. Okay.
The song's called 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42 for any Lost fans out there. That's all right.
You love packing groceries and living your life like it is make-believe. Applying personality to everything you see. Celery, fresh greens are good for the skin you wear. Keep it clean and keep it safe, or else it wears away. A brand new day is coming up. I'll hold on to you if you will lean on me. Steer this ship of fools onto an empty stream. I'll hold on to you if you can promise not to dive off into the rolling waves and drift away. I'm digging deep into my brand new fables, open up the mind again. Twist it open like a sealed can of vitamins. I'm a feather on the surface of a lake, and I need a hand to pull me down beneath the burning of the breeze. My love was killing me. Brand new day is coming up. I'll hold on to you if you will lean on me. Steer this ship of fools onto an rolling waves and drift away. Drift away.
Dive off into the rolling waves and drift away.
And drift away.
And dive off into the rolling waves. Dive off into the rolling waves. Let's hop into a box and
could ship ourselves far away from here with no return address. Live like every day is our last until the days fade away and there's nothing left. Let's hop in our box and ship ourselves far away from here.
That was Jaime Anaremo of the band Like I Was the Fire playing some songs off of their upcoming EP, The Narrow Escapes. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for the music.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You.
How are you guys feeling today?
Good.
Pretty good. Pretty good. Great.
So you self-produce most of your music, right?
Yeah. We have two EPs so far. Last year in August, we released our first one, which was 100% produced by us in every aspect. And then at the end of the month, our next EP is coming out, which is like 98% produced by us. So, yeah.
What about that last 2% there?
The last 2%, we had a friend of our bassist record us.
Okay,
and
great.
Kind of master us.
Listen, I got to ask, it's coming out on Halloween. Is there any significance there?
Well, we had several original release dates, and then that got pushed back due to all kinds of issues. And then I looked at the image one day, and I'm like, what's coming up that we could do this for? And I was like, this is perfect for Halloween. So I asked Jaime, and I was like, yeah, okay, let's do it. So, yeah.
Why don't you describe the image, the artwork, because, you know, can't see it really.
We are on the radio.
It's a little hard to describe. In a nutshell, it's what used to be a four-headed monster running from a wizard that has chopped one of its heads off.
Yeah.
So, and they're running and screaming in terror. Even though you can't hear it, you can kind of see it on their faces.
Yeah, they look like they're screaming.
Yeah.
That does sound like Halloween.
Oh, yeah, and there's blood splattering everywhere. So.
Oh, now it sounds like Dexter. Yeah.
There you go.
why did you decide to self-promote without any label backup, without any managers or promoters or anything like that? What's the impetus for that? What kind of benefit do you receive?
Well, I think primarily it was kind of by necessity. You know, we're a young band, and every band starts off kind of in the same spot for the most part. With no backing other than themselves. And in this day and age, there are a lot more tools available to bands to be able to produce a lot of things by themselves. And our skill set as people in our band seem to kind of lend itself to it. Like, I know a fair amount about recording. Aremo does all of our artwork for our posters and everything. And
And we've been in enough fail bands to know what we've done wrong.
That too.
So we can apply those steps to everything we're doing forward. And, you know, and it's in New York City. All bands are kind of clawing for attention in the same ways. So it's almost better to just do what you can on your own.
Yeah.
You know?
So we have a question from a listener. They want to know, what does DIY culture mean in the music industry right now in the scene?
Right now, I think it means really without kind of a backbone of label or manager or press support for the most part. I mean, you have tools like where you can digitally release your music now with the internet. In music nowadays, you don't even really need a physical release to still achieve, you know, some semblance of financial success or recognition. You know, we have our YouTube culture where you can write one, you know, catchy song, And if enough people, you know, look at it, you get advertising money and everything without, you know, any kind of label, and you're doing it all yourself.
So you mentioned you guys have been in failed bands before. What, and you learned some lessons. I'm wondering if you could clarify a little bit. What kind of lessons?
I mean, I know coming from mine, you learn lessons about what kind of people to let into your band, how to judge who's serious and who's just kind of in it for hobby, and then just, you know, what to do to make sure you guys are actually about something and you're not just practicing, you know, week after week, lending money to rehearsal studios for no reason. You know, I did that for a long time, and there was no, it took me about a year to realize that there was no goal. So that's when that ended, and I, you know, I tried to do it again with an actual goal in mind.
So. Do you think DIY culture helps you achieve that goal? Helps you keep you focused, keep you on message?
Definitely keeps you busy.
Yeah, definitely.
Very, very busy.
Because it forces you to think about things besides just playing the songs, which is what millions upon millions of like bedroom and bass room bands start out doing. And then once they realize they have to get down to the business of it, a lot of people get maybe turned away from it. But if you're about it, then you have to do it.
Yeah, you get kind of a taste for the industry without actually, you know, being too much into the corporate side of it, I guess. Like, I mean, we do all of our press and booking stuff, and a lot of those duties previously, you know, like 10, 15 years ago, would have been done by someone else most of the time.
Someone actually qualified.
Yeah, right.
Well, that taste of the recording industry, if we're to believe the recording industry, the Association of America, they monitor record sales, that taste is really, really bitter right now. But I'm wondering, that's coming from people who make their living selling CDs, selling physical copies. I'm wondering whether it tastes so bitter to you guys when you're actually out there on the front lines doing things yourself.
I feel like when we do this kind of thing, when you're a DIY band, you're looking for a different kind of taste. Like, those people are looking to see numbers and to see sales, whereas, at our stage in the game, I'm happy if people are trying to steal our music, because that means people are listening to it. So I don't really care about what numbers are actually technically being sold.
Yeah.
I just care that people are, like, happy about a song. I'm like, oh, you listen to it. That's what matters to me.
What we're actually doing right now, which you would never see, well, yeah, you'd never see a band on a major label do, is on our new EP that's coming out. You can download the first song for free on our Bandcamp right now, completely free. Just download the song until the album's released. Then, you know, you can get it with the rest of the album.
Well, I hate to point this out, but Radiohead gave an entire album away, didn't they?
Yeah,
but then again, they did it themselves too,
they did
didn't
do it themselves.
They? Yeah. All right.
Yeah, so.
That's true.
And so, it's also, you know, I mean, a lot of that model now, since then, is kind of what lends itself to Bandcamp, where you can get our release. That actually was a big influence on how Bandcamp started in the first place, which is a really cool concept of, you know, you can set a minimum amount for an album, and whatever someone feels like the music's worth, they can donate even more than that. I mean, our EP last year, just like a small example, you know, we sold it for $4, and some people would buy it for like $5, even just a dollar
extra.
Somebody
bought it for 10.
Yeah,
one,
you know,
person, one of Sal's friends, I think, bought it for $10. I was
exactly.
Like, all right, thank you.
Yeah, you know, it's. I feel like that's the way it should be. You know, music should be valued more than just, you know, just something on your iPod, just something, a soundtrack of your life, you know.
You mentioned spending a lot of money on recording studios and studio time, which is really, really expensive. But recording equipment is pretty expensive as well. How long does it take to sort of make your money back, to see the benefit of owning your own equipment versus having to go somewhere and pay someone else to do it?
Well, for me, it's more time than anything. I mean, our first EP last year, we recorded it over a few months in various places, in our drummer's basement and, you know, in bedrooms and offices and whatever. And for me, I recorded it and I have very little equipment. And
how
that's
the
kind
neighbors
of
feel about it.
Well, the nice thing about it was that the neighbors didn't really hear much at all. I mean, mostly we recorded vocals, and then I just have one mic and I have my laptop. And nowadays, when it comes to recording, there are digital audio workstations like Logic Pro and Pro Tools, which can do a lot digitally that you'd have to use analog methods for many years ago.
Yeah,
so it saves a lot on costs. I mean, it's not quite the same sound, but, you know, for our purposes, for what we, you know, need to do, it worked.
I mean, getting that kind of the equipment and stuff, too, it's just like you would do with a computer or anything else you kind of really want. It's an investment, and you're going to use it you know, you're going to get the most use out of it if you really want it. So it's not really like, it's not really money lost. You know, even songs that don't make it to the stage, you know, we just kind of sit at home and use this equipment for ourselves and
that's
make,
a nice
make little
thing.
Fun things, you know, all the time anyway.
Definitely. So. Like, it's versus spending money at a studio where you're spending money and what you get is what you get. Everything you're spending money towards for home recording, you're keeping. Like, it's yours now. So you can keep using it.
Well, I'm sure that social media must play a big role in what you're doing as well. You know, you don't have a manager, you don't have a promoter, you do all of that yourself. Could you talk real quickly about, you know, what Twitter and Facebook and maybe even MySpace have done to change the music industry?
Oh, man.
MySpace
so much.
Has done nothing.
Yeah. MySpace well, it did, like, 10 years ago it did.
Yeah, we came in at the end of MySpace.
Yeah.
I don't know why they still exist. We still have a MySpace page. And
I don't give it to anyone.
I only like it because I made little what are they called, widgets? Or
You made little 8-bit characters, like Nintendo characters.
I animated us on MySpace, which is the only reason why I haven't deleted that account yet, because it's just fun to look at. But otherwise, yeah, Facebook and Twitter have been great.
Yeah, I'm
great social vocal cords for like the band because they're free. You know, we can post as much stuff as we have on there. And it's great because a lot of people have those pages, like band pages or whatever. You're linking that to like your personal account, so your friends can always see what you're doing. And either you can direct people there, but a lot of people are even just curious if they're on your personal page and see what else you're doing. They're like, oh, you're in a band? That's cool. So it's nice to have it all synced together.
Yeah, and I love Twitter for the same reason I love Bandcamp, in that it breaks down barriers that used to exist between artists and fan. Bandcamp, when you buy music on there, you're paying the artist directly most of the time. On Twitter, you tweeting most of the time. I mean, there are plenty of big bands who use Twitter and they have, you know, a Twitter person they probably pay. But a lot of the bands we know and a lot of indie bands, you know, they're just running their own Twitters and you can just talk to each other and it's great. It's a great, you know, seamless form of communication. Yeah, it's really cool.
Do you guys have any shows coming up?
No.
Trying to be a little bit more, not like we can't, but we're trying to be a bit more strategic about what shows we play and when. And noticing last year, since we're still kind of new, this was like a really tough season to get and play a successful show, because this is like the holiday season. People just started school. Right. Holidays are coming up. People might be going away or doing whatever. So it's a little tough, but we're definitely keeping our eyes up, and we might have one soon. But
yeah, we're focusing more kind of on the interweb space at the moment with the new release, kind of promoting it, and then
and doing great things like this
after that. Yeah, exactly,
just talking as much as we can.
All right, that was Jaime and Aremo from the band Like I Was the Fire. Do you guys want to play one more song, take us out?
Sure. This song is actually the free song that you can download right now. It's called Risk Control.
Okay.
I'm running out of excuses so fast. My knees are buckling and can't last. So lock the door and swallow the key. Don't spit it back at me. How else could I survive without a girl like you to make me toss and turn all night? When I am lost, you will find that you never forget me. How else could I survive without a girl like you to make me toss and turn all night? When I am lost, you will. Racing the ground back and forth in my city, saying you really miss me. You're a junkie who needs a fix, and I'm the enabler. I keep taking you in. Is there a single person in this room who's learned from their mistakes? 'Cause I wanna learn from you. Pry me out of this hell. How else could I survive without a girl like you to make me toss and turn all night? When I am lost, you will find. How else could I survive without a girl like you? You can toss and turn all night. When I am lost, you will find that you never forget.
swallow my tongue, I'll swallow my tongue. If you give me a second of your time, I'll swallow my tongue, I'll swallow my tongue. If you give me a second of your time, I'll swallow my tongue, I'll swallow my tongue. If you give me a second of your time, I'll swallow my tongue, I'll swallow my tongue. If you give me a second of your time, I'll swallow my tongue, I'll swallow my tongue. If you give me a second of your time, I'll swallow my tongue,
I'll swallow my tongue.
Second of your time,
I'll swallow my tongue,
I'll swallow my tongue. If you give me a second of your time, I'll swallow my tongue,
I'll swallow my tongue.
If you give me a second of your time,
oh damn, I lost.
Could I survive without a girl like you to make me toss and turn all night? When I am lost, you will find that you never forget me. How else could I survive without a girl like you to make me toss and turn all night? When I am
And that was Like I Was the Fire, a local band whose EP, The Narrow Escapes, will be out on Halloween. You can get it at www.likeiwasthefire.bandcamp.com. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, since the Occupy Wall Street protesters set up camp 4 weeks ago, they've had to do most things themselves. Bullhorns, tents, and tarps are banned, so many protesters get creative. Rasmus Ron West sent us this audio postcard from the Financial District.
Wall Street. Join the General Assembly.
Mic check.
Mic check.
If you're interested.
If you're interested.
In learning more.
In learning more.
About direct democracy.
I'm Micah. I'm from Columbus, Ohio, and I work as a line cook out there. I'm kind of on leave from Ohio State University right now. I'm part of what we're calling Namaska Corner. This is the name of our camp. We're in between two granite benches. We're kind of using one of the benches as a headboard. We have an air mattress and a mattress, and we just basically have a big cuddle puddle every night. The first night I slept on a pizza box.
That's what it's all about, my phone's ringing.
That was Micah Chamberlain giving us a tour of his outdoor bedroom. Chamberlain is one of many Occupy Wall Street protesters who heard the call to action online. He hitchhiked to New York City to join the movement. And that is all the time we have today. Thank you so much for joining us. Audio Files is a production of CUNY Graduate School of Journalism in Times Square, New York. Our producer today is Rachel Janashvili. I'm your host, Franz Koster. And to see you off, here is Sex Pistols frontman Sid Vicious taking a Sinatra classic and doing it his way.
I did it my-